Merry Christmas!
Get the cheese to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished. So, what's next?
Welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast festively brought to you by Nerd and Ty and Cages. Are you annoyed with your amnesiac workers wandering off and getting lost? Stick them in a cage. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn, a writer, and I love roaming around a good castle.
I'm Mars Reed Lobato, and I make the Blake 7 references. I'm Miles Alexander Reed Lobato, and I make the Blake 7 references.
Wow. Hang on, so does that mean you're Marl?
Yes, I am Marl.
Okay, Marl. So, each episode, we watch stories from three different Star Trek shows and rank them on a big list of best to worst. But this time, as we've done for previous festive episodes, we're actually having a rummage around in Santa's sack and seeing what we can provide to one another as a gift of an episode. Is it going to be a cracker or a lump of coal? But
Charlie, do you know what would be a nice gift from you to me? It's if you never use the phrase rummage around in Santa's sack ever again. Because this is Star Trek. We know how sometimes a sack could actually be SAC.
Oh God, that's a horrible idea. Just, yeah, some kind of alien Santa, like, birthing things forth from his festive sack.
I think they did that in the DC Next Gen comic.
Well, yeah, moving swiftly on from that. What non-Star Trek thing has been bringing you joy in the year of 2024, the year of Luigi, the fourth plague year,
I have been enjoying Absolute Superman issue 2.
Ooh.
I admit, when I first heard that of the DC Absolute, which is yet another kind of ultimate style rejig of the DC universe, and I saw the new designs for Batman, where he's designed to look like a JoJo's character.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman with the tats, and Superman with like the long flowing hair, but not like the mullet, but more like just a big mop of hair. I admit my first reactions were, this looks like it's trying to be edgy as fuck. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be bloody stupid. But I decided to give it a try. I decided to give the books a try. Absolute Batman issue 1 was decent, but I wasn't really kind of getting it. Wonder Woman was definitely an improvement. And I love a good take on Superman, where the first time we see him, he is defending mine workers and beating up private security. Because one of my earliest favorite Superman comic stories is the one where he disguises himself as a mine worker to trick a corrupt CEO into improving working conditions for miners. I think he only appears in costume as Superman for like one panel where he's running to the mine, because this is back before Superman couldn't fly, and he then spends the rest of the time disguised as a square-jawed miner.
Yeah, it's Absolute Superman's been very good fun so far. I was a little uncertain about their use of Lois Lane as part of this private military company, but it looks like that might develop and grow in some fun ways. And yeah, they've given Superman a kind of Bayonetta costume where it can kind of remove itself to become a kind of weird, like, red dust movable cape thing that can turn into stuff.
It feels like, you know, they took the Kryptonian armor of the new 52 Superman and said, why don't we actually do something interesting with this? The suit also has an AI, which is called Sol. At first, I thought it was like reference to Superman getting his powers from the sun. So I thought, does this Superman get his powers from Sol? Then I realized that his Fortress of Solitude is the suit.
Mm.
And the suit keeps telling him not to save these people because they're not worth it, because Earth is heading on the path of its own destruction as Krypton is. And Superman does what Superman does best, which is basically say, F that, I am going to help these people in the most Superman way. And I kind of like it.
Yeah.
I dig it.
Yeah. The world of the absolute titles being one where it's like, yeah, like, how do you make a new ultimate universe or a new universe where it's for present day? Well, present day feels like it's all collapsing pretty horrendously, and, you know, the wrong people are in power and bad, and fascism's on the rise and all of that. Well, yeah, this absolute universe is how you represent that and go, yeah, you've got these private military companies being complete shits. You've got, you know, all these kind of things going on. And with acting as resistance to it, you have Wonder Woman, you have Batman, and you've got Superman. And it's been really entertaining so far.
And I like the new recontextualization of Krypton, which I swear happens every like 10 to 15 years with a new reboot.
Yeah.
And this feels like a good combination of the very kind of pulp sci-fi Krypton of the Silver Age and the very kind of cold, sterile, all birthing matrixes and eradicators of the John Byrne Man of Steel post-crisis reboot of Superman, but in a nice combination. I like how the Superman logo has been turned from a family crest to a caste symbol.
Yeah.
To signify the working caste and people who dare speak out against the very scientifically decadent Kryptonian, higher class of Kryptonian society. So when Superman is literally wearing the Superman logo, it doesn't stand for hope in a banal Jeff Johnsian kind of way. It does feel like he's saying, I am the champion of the oppressed. And I am wearing the symbol of the oppressed of my society on my chest.
Cool.
And Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying in the year of our Luigi 2024.4?
Well, I've been enjoying, as people can probably guess from a lot of my enjoyment segments in previous episodes, I've been enjoying comics.
What a twist.
I know, me, of all people. Specifically, though, 2000 AD and manga have both been like constant reads for me now. Both the subscription to 2000 AD that I've got and going back through the older titles now. You know, again, see Strontium Dog in a kind of weird battle royale situation, and, you know, like Rogue Trooper, where Gunner seems to have a new body. Oh my god. And Rogue would be pleased, but it's all a bit suspicious why he is like that. And manga wise, I've been reading Spy X Family, and it's been utterly adorable.
Yeah, Spy Family is... I think, didn't I recommend you check out Spy Family earlier this year on the podcast?
Probably, yeah. I know it was on my favourites list on the Shonen Jump app. And when it was on the War Rocket Ajax reading list recently, I started and then just kept going and kept going. As, yeah, you've got a spy and an assassin, both in a fake marriage with each other, not knowing the other one is an assassin and a spy, respectively. And a psychic child, Anya, who's been fostered by them, again, to keep the pretense of a family for this spy's mission. And I wasn't sure how that would be of like, oh, ho, she knows all of this. She's a gremlin. She is just like...
she.
She is an idiot in the best way possible. So
she Anya is an adorable Muppet of a child who essentially chooses, who knows everything and chooses violence every time.
Yeah, yeah. It's the fact that she has very few skills or abilities or even ways to express, given she's quite young, like younger than her peers in school. And just the look she has sometimes of like realizing how much blood both her fake parents are shedding or is going to be, like, the violence that's going to be happening to them. And yeah, just that manic energy of it all has been very good fun.
In classic 2080, where are you right now?
March 1984.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've got DR and Quinch. That's been the most recent title that's just started. Yeah, literally where I'm at was The Haunting of Sector 9, and yeah, Strontium Dog finished his lengthy battle royale type thing. So yeah, nothing new's popped up beyond DR and Quinch yet.
Okay, has Zenith started yet, or is that coming? Nope. Is that okay?
No, yeah.
I think you said you're in the 500s.
400s, I think.
400s. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So yeah, it's been a fun year of discovering things which I probably should have read a long time ago, but have been enjoying anyway.
Has ABC Warriors The Black Hole started yet?
Nope.
Nope. Which book of Nemesis are you on?
Oh god, that the last one was, it was book 3, I think.
Okay. All right. So, because you get book four, The Gothic Empire, and I think that's where it switches from O'Neill to Brian Talbot.
Okay. Oh, yes. Yeah, so 362, I think, was the most recent one I read. So, yeah. So, I've still got a way to go.
You have.
Yeah. But, yes, it's been a good time reading those, and definitely recommend checking them both out. The Shonen Jump app is shockingly cheap, and, 2000 AD, while it's a little pricier getting the physical ones in, it's still nice getting a comic through the letterbox. And
yeah, I am envious, because the 2000 AD app is really good. I have a subscription to both that and the Judge Dredd magazine. The trouble is, when it's a digital thing and not like a physical comic, it does tend to digitally pile up, because, you know, as much as I've had to learn how to enjoy digital comics and books, there is just that tactileness of just opening a book and reading it.
Definitely. Right, well, something that's not tactile is my gift to you.
Where did you get Space 1999 wall wrapping paper?
I mean, I just tore up some old fanzines. They're probably not worth much, right?
No. Okay, all right.
And wipe some of the membrane from Santa's sack off of it as well.
Okay, I'm just going to tear this open and... Oh, it's an episode of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, yeah. I heard you like Star Trek, so I thought I'm
aware of its work.
Good, good. So yeah, specifically though, this is Star Trek Deep Space Nine Season 6, Episode 15, titled Honor Among Thieves. This came out on the 21st of February 1998 with a teleplay by Renee Echevarria, a story by Philip Kim, and directed by Alan Eastman. The UK number one hit was Celine Dion with My Heart Will Go On, and the US had Usher with Nice and Slow. Oh my god. So the Usher one, I thought, I was like, oh yeah, I know a bunch of Usher songs. I did not remember this one at all.
Yeah, the Usher song was fine. My Heart Will Go On. I mean, okay. I like the song unironically. It's fine. I do miss... Would you call this a power ballad?
I don't know. I don't know if I'd call it a power ballad, but I definitely get where you're coming from with it.
Because I just kind of feel like, you know, it's a musical. I know I've said on the podcast before, it's a musical form I would like to return to, like, mainstream music. Because, yeah, I'm a child of the 80s and 90s. I do miss when movies had, like, a tie-in six-minute song which would storm the charts. Like, yeah, okay, fine. I miss the Bryan Adams, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. You know, when that was, like, the number one song for, like, a number three movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. There is something, like, about that kind of a song where I couldn't say I like My Heart Will Go On, but it's a thing that's there, you know? I'm pretty sure it transitioned from Radio 1 over to Classic FM pretty quickly. And it's like, yeah, weird, but it's almost like, yeah, here's this thing from a film from the late 90s, and it's kind of canonized fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Yes, so I've picked this for you for one specific reason here. And yeah, it's an exciting guest star.
Ooh.
Yeah. So.
Does it have something to do with the Space 1999 wallpaper?
Maybe. Yeah, do we want to get into that before your recap? Or
Yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah, okay. So yeah, Nick Tate had guest starred on an episode of TNG, and after the original choice of actor for Liam Bilby in this passed away, Nick jumped at the job and loved the idea of the role, especially in a universe like Star Trek. So I thought we'd get some fun times out of him here.
And Nick Tate, for those who didn't listen to our Space Camps episode, he plays the Eagle pilot Alan in Space 1999. So he's the closest thing that show gets to, like, a kind of a swashbuckling heroic pulp hero type, because Koenig is essentially walking around doing, like, you know, checking that they've not misused their paperclip budgets and looking at different alien societies who have all endorsed some form of eugenics program and gone, no, you're all weird. Stop it.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a change acting wise for him, but yeah, hopefully one that he can do all right by. So with that in mind, time to get up to some shady things. Beginning now.
Chief Miles O'Brien is away, and DS9 is just falling apart without him. Whenever he's away, the engineering teams just can't make the clashing Federation and Cardassian computer systems work like he can. Now that's what I call job security. Bashir asks Sisko where O'Brien is, because, you know, Bashir and O'Brien are mates, and he's kind of worried. And Sisko can't tell him. Boy, I sure hope that O'Brien isn't doing spy work for Starfleet Intelligence trying to infiltrate the Orion Syndicate. Hey, Charlie, guess what?
What?
O'Brien is doing spy work for Starfleet Intelligence and is trying to infiltrate the Orion Syndicate on a planet called Farius Prime.
Oh my God!
Now, after last week's shockingly terrible attempt at espionage in the Enterprise incident, this attempt is slightly better, though still bloody baffling. 5 Starfleet intelligence officers have been killed by the Orion Syndicate, raising fears of a mole. So O'Brien has been sent behind the Iron Curtain into the Czech Republic to see if the mole is either George Smiley, Esterhazy, Roy Bland, Hayden, and Percy Allerline. Oh, wait, sorry, no. That's the John le Carré novel Tinker, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, which is a fantastic novel, a fantastic BBC miniseries starring Alec Guinness, and a fantastic film starring Gary Oldman as Smiley. Okay, look, you see, because O'Brien is an engineer, that makes him the perfect okay, look, it Hang makes on. No sense if you think about this for more than 30 seconds, but this is the plot of the episode, so we're gonna have to make this work. Okay, we're going to go with the idea that because O'Brien's not Starfleet intelligence, he won't be recognized by any mole. O'Brien's been eyeing this particular gang of Orion Syndicate members, Bilby, Filth, and Kroll, and he's able to work his way into the gang with the help of some faulty electrics and doing the old running in to save the day before someone dies routine. Bilby, kind of the boss of these three guys, he takes a shine to O'Brien, who is operating under the name of Connolly. Bilby might be a thief, a murderer, an Australian, and a top Eagle pilot, but he seems pretty happy with his criminal life. He even has family back on New Sydney, far away from his criminal dealings. But he does have a cat, Chester. He's not a cheater, though. O'Brien helps Bilby fix some Klingon disruptors, which are going to be used for a job that the Orions have coming up. O'Brien is getting more and more into the gang and keeps reporting back to his handler, Chadwick, who fails at being an intelligence officer by just standing outside a pub looking conspicuous. Every time O'Brien thinks he's got enough to get out, Chadwick tells him, yeah, no, I need you to infiltrate this gang on Saturday. So O'Brien is taken by Bilby to Bilby's boss, Ramus, and Bilby witnesses for O'Brien. Unlike in the film Mad Max Fury Road, witnessing doesn't mean spraying your mouth silver, grabbing some explosives, and jumping into a death wagon. No. In the Orion Syndicate, witnessing essentially means that if something goes wrong, if O'Brien fucks up, it's going to be Bilby who takes responsibility and no one else. And man, the Orion Syndicate is better run than most jobs I've worked at, where if you do something wrong, you get 10 people telling you fucked up, but if you do something right, you get nothing. Chadwick gets O'Brien the parts he needs to fix the disruptors, and he gets them from the Klingon ambassador, Farius. But when Ramus presses Bilby to say where he got the kit he needed, O'Brien lies and says that he stole them, earning Bilby's trust and respect. None of the others in his little gang would ever stick up for him. So he buys O'Brien a nicely dull gray suit, just like his, and tells O'Brien that, hey, if you're careful and if you're smart, you can make something of yourself, even in this rough criminal life. O'Brien is able to find out that the mole he's looking for worked on Riser's weather control systems a year ago. Right, job done. O'Brien wants out. Oh, by the way, the Orion Syndicate is actually working with the Dominion via a halter named Gelnon. Unfortunately, this means we're deprived of Jeffrey Combs' cameo. Boo! Gelnon was the one who wanted the disruptors, and when he doubts O'Brien's veracity, Bilby vouches for him, saying he trusts Connolly, and thus putting his own neck in the noose if anything goes wrong. O'Brien helps Bilby do a bank job, still trying to get to the bottom of the whole Dominion scheme. Bilby tries to get O'Brien laid with a sex worker, but O'Brien refuses.
Alarm! Alarm! Yeah, that's five. Carry on with your sex worker talk.
Fantastic. O'Brien, Bilby tries to get O'Brien time with a sex worker, but O'Brien refuses. He has a girlfriend in New Canada. She works in a flower shop. You can't meet her. Honest. Bilby tells O'Brien that he always has his back, and that when he advances in the syndicate, so will O'Brien. Something that gets gruesomely shown when Fliff, one of the other members of the gang, gets killed for skimming money from the syndicate. O'Brien is feeling pretty bad about betraying a man who has been nothing but nice to him. But Conley doesn't care. Bilby chose this life. He knows what could happen, and that if he dies when O'Brien gets extracted, then hey, that's just something O'Brien's going to have to deal with. You would think intelligence officers would be better with dealing with their operatives than this, right? Eventually, the Dominion's plans are revealed. They're going to kill the Klingon ambassador, Farius. Turns out, there's a sizable part of the Klingon Empire who don't want to be allied with the Federation in the war against the Dominion. They just want to kind of, you know, lock down their borders and not get involved. Even though Garron, in hysteria-eyed madness, is advocating the alliance. By making it look like loyalists to Garron killed the ambassador, it would martyr his cause and thus strengthens the call to withdraw from the war. O'Brien tells Chadwick, He's going to warn the Klingon ambassador, but they're going to let the plan go ahead just enough so the Orion Syndicate operatives will get caught and killed by the Klingons. O'Brien doesn't like this, but Chadwick tells him that the greater good of protecting their allies and wider security for the Federation is more important than people who just chose a criminal life. Punching Chadwick out, O'Brien spills the beans to Bilby, telling him to call in sick or something, telling him, oh, by the way, it's a trap. With no choice, O'Brien reveals the truth, and Bilby is devastated that O'Brien, someone he really trusted, actually betrayed him. Because no matter O'Brien's good intentions, Bilby's a dead man walking now. Even if he turns himself in, that's not going to protect his family from the Orions. Bilby wasn't even the guy O'Brien was trying to catch. He was just the guy O'Brien chose to blunder his way into the Syndicate. With no good choices, Bilby's still going to go on the mission, even though he's going to die while doing so. But if he does it that way, both O'Brien and his own family will be safe, and that's what's important to him. But Bilby asks O'Brien one last favor. Look after my cat for me. Now, back on the station, with Bilby good and dead, and the Federation Klingon Alliance still intact, O'Brien has to deal with the consequences of his actions. Chadwick didn't mention the part about O'Brien beating him up in his report. Bashir tells Miles that he was just doing his duty, but that doesn't make Miles feel any better. What probably doesn't make him feel any better is that after we cut the closing credits, he probably hears the unmistakable sound of Chester the cat coughing up a hairball behind the sofa. A sound which fills any cat owner with dread and foreboding.
Wow. That's 3 minutes and 20 over. So, Mars, are you much of a kind of mafia film person?
Not particularly. Like, I know I've seen The Godfather, like, once when I was 17, and I was kind of bored by it. I do kind of prefer your kind of, like, your kind of 60s British gangster movies. Like, oh, yeah. you get Carter's, your Italian Jobs, like, it's like with spy work. I either want like my spy stories to be like the Avengers and be utterly ludicrous and insane and stupid.
Yep.
Or your John le Carré, which is your sexually frustrated, overweight middle managers doing spy work in between having to file copious amounts of paperwork to your handlers.
Wow.
And so, yeah. I really like Bilby because he didn't feel like, you know, it feels whenever we get criminal syndicates in Star Trek, they do tend to be of the kind of Godfather mafioso variety and not just like this very kind of cheeky gangster chap who's just kind of, you know, he's in it, but he's going to be a nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching this thinking, was it this year or last year I saw Goodfellas? And like that is a good fun movie. Still, like I'm not a massive gangster movie kind of person. I watch Sopranos, but you know I'm a big HBO prestige TV person. And yeah, it was interesting seeing. Oh yeah, even in space, you've got these kind of dodgier elements. It's not all the kind of nice space colonies from. The original series and even a lot of TNG. So seeing this kind of seamy underbelly with people like Bilby and his mates, it was good fun. You know, although, yeah, why was O'Brien here?
It's like, I get that they probably wanted like an engineer to kind of, you know, to kind of infiltrate because he's kind of like the fix-it man. But surely intelligence officer, you can train an intelligence officer or recruit an engineer to be an intelligence officer as a long-standing career thing and not just, hey, we spoke to Cisco, your schedule's free for the next month. We're going to need you to do some wet work.
Yeah, I know, like, he's someone who has had previous combat experience, that kind of thing. maybe there's an amount of that, or, you know, being an enlisted person, maybe it's easier to go, oh yeah, he wouldn't be as prestigious a person as, you know, getting a Riker or someone.
Yeah, but also, as we saw in the Enterprise incident, they don't want a Kirk. He's gonna run in bilby face, doing his best fake Australian accent and punching everyone he sees until he gets to the top of the Orion Syndicate.
True. I mean, maybe that's it. Maybe they were like, look, who's your most put upon guy? Who's someone that isn't going to go out of his way, isn't going to be weird about it, isn't going to get too involved? And of course, you know, even then, O'Brien starts feeling for Bilby and, you know, like hearing about his family and kind of not quite being Bilby's son, but definitely that kind of, I don't know, almost like younger sibling sort of feeling of like, oh, you know, we're mates now.
Yeah, I read in the notes that they kind of wanted the father and son kind of dynamic with Bilby and O'Brien, which felt really weird because I felt both actors were almost close to the same age.
Yes. Yeah, that's what kind of takes away from that kind of sense. I don't know, maybe that sort of mentor-mentee kind of thing. Like, I've mentioned a few times my late mentor and manager at Dave's Comics, Steve Bamford. I think he was 9 years older than me. So again, it wasn't the parental thing. It wasn't really an older brother thing, but there was definitely that kind of, you know, a nice, slightly older male role model.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But you'd be like, yeah, okay, right. Here's someone that is virtually family. So yeah, it's interesting seeing this kind of a friendship where it's not, you know, O'Brien and Bashir as the likely lads running around, getting into jokes.
You know that when Bashir eventually finds out that O'Brien was away doing spy work, you know he's pissed off. Because, yeah, you know, I Bashir has sent notes to Starfleet Intelligence going, look, if you need a doctor for a spy mission, I am your guy. I've got character notes.
Oh, God.
Like, I've got a backstory worked out for my character. I have a limp. I have a noticeable limp that I've been practicing in my spare time, because you know Bashir would be the most basic bitch at Spycraft.
Definitely. You'd be like, oh, could I get a badge that also has a laser in it or something?
Could I have like an artificial arm with like some spy gadgets put in? Look, I'll put my original arm on ice and I'll just put it back on after we're done. Kind of like a metal arm that I have to physically move like the guy in Young Frankenstein.
Oh, God. Yeah, and at that point, Starfleet Intelligence went, well, we definitely can't take him, who is literally the next guy, and it was O'Brien. And that's how he got hired for this mission.
It's like, you know, I think even Dax would be better at spy work than Julian Bashir.
Yeah, I mean, Dax does feel like, again, should probably have a character for it.
Oh, definitely.
O'Brien is just like, I'm filing the edges off of O'Brien, you know? Like, I'm just going to be here and put upon. And my regular life, there and put upon. Job done. No real acting needed. Like, when he was coming up with the girlfriend, it's like, oh, no. Now he's actually going to have to lie. And he can't quite get there. He's like, she's Kamiko, and she runs a flower shop. Yes, good one.
You know that when the DS9 crew sit down to play Dungeons and Dragons, like, O'Brien is the guy who's just like, I am Eddie Brian O, and I am a rogue, a level one rogue.
God, his. Like, there's almost every year there seems to be the disappointing statistics from D&D Beyond that their most common character build is basically a human fighter called Bob. That kind of thing. It's like, guys, like, make even the slightest effort. But no, O'Brien is the guy that would make the human fighter called Bob.
Look, in O'Brien's defense, he seems to have no free time because apparently the moment he leaves, Deep Space Nine breaks down.
Oh my god, yeah. Like, what are the other engineers doing? Are they just holding pieces together until he can get there? Like, look, we've got these two pipes. One's Cardassian, one's Federation. Even worse, there's some Bajoran tech over there, and that's not looking good either. Like, what do they do? I mean, they had a slightly weaselly guy around who seemed to be there when O'Brien wasn't about. But, like, yeah, no one seems to do anything.
Maybe it's just Rom hitting stuff with a pipe.
Oh, God, possibly, yeah. Well, Rom's been the great kind of, like, spit and duct tape kind of engineer. Yep. Of, like, here, this spatula will just about keep the station from falling apart. So, again, maybe he's doing that while O'Brien sleeps and isn't constantly on call.
Maybe Rom has just has persuaded the guy to stand on a pedestal with one leg like raised 2 feet in the air while they manipulate an egg whisk at a particular speed, and that keeps the replicators working.
Yeah, that person's in engineering now. That's how they get you.
Originally, I read that this was meant to be like a comedy episode. With Jake.
Oh.
I think I read that somewhere.
What, with Jake as the spy?
Here we go. Philip Kim's original idea for this episode was a quick story involving Jake saving the life of a daughter of the Orion Syndicate's leader. And due to his actions, Jake is befriended by a number of high-ranking Syndicate members. At first, he loves it. New friends able to get him anything he wants, whenever he wants. However, Jake and Nog have a small argument on the promenade next day. Jake discovers that Nog is in the infirmary after suffering a nasty beating. At this point, Jake realizes he's into something he can't control, and he goes to his father to help. The comic element of the story was to come from the fact that while Jake is trying to extricate himself from the Syndicate, Quark is trying to work his way into it, so he decides to become Jake's new best friend. I don't know. Yeah. Like, I mean, okay, I feel that Jake doesn't get enough to do on the show regardless.
Yeah.
But just no.
At the same time, like, I could get more of a father-son thing going on. And it feels almost like elements from some of those early bits of Goodfellas of going, yeah, you got this kid doing favors for, you know, some friendly guys that happen to be local crime bosses. Kind of thing. But yeah, I think this feels more interesting than that would have been.
Yeah. So how did you feel about, you know, the Bilby character?
I liked him. He was good fun. It was that terrible thing of, just stop talking, mate. I'm sympathizing with you, and it's not going to end well. Yeah. Like, in another life, then maybe he and O'Brien could have remained friends, but this was a doomed career path. And, like, when he took the decision to go, like, well, fuck, I mean, I'm dead then. Like, I have to go through with it and go willingly into this trap and die, because if it's found out that I knew any of this, my family are fucked.
Yeah.
I'm
surprised that, like, you kind of do feel sorry for him, because, like, normally when this kind of happens in, like, a crime drama, it's just like, it's like Chadwick says, like, yeah, he's a criminal, he chose his life, he's gonna get what essentially he deserves.
Mm.
But it never feels like, you know, Bilby is just like the middleman in a crime gang. He's not like the Cray brothers. He's not, you know, he's not Robert De Niro in The Godfather. He's the guy who's just like, yeah, I made this my life, and I made it work.
Yeah, it worked comfortably for him for a time, and unfortunately led here. And it's nice that even in something like Star Trek, which can often be seen as being, like, on the surface, being quite black and white,
Yeah,
it isn't so much here. Like, this is still a person. And especially lately watching a bunch of skip intro videos on Copaganda, and on shows like Law and Order and Blue Bloods and all of that, where you see the kind of reveling in the breaking the kind of like disrespecting their own system, even for the law, and trying, and every criminal is obviously a two-dimensional baddie, and it doesn't matter what they do because it's always bad, and it doesn't matter what we do either because we're always good, kind of stuff of going like, yeah, O'Brien's stuck.
O'Brien,
like, O'Brien, no one's in a good situation.
No, his handler is the worst.
Yes, yeah, not only at espionage, but like the fact that it felt like he was just yards away at all times, shadily kind of lurking around. So yeah, they probably know, like Fliff and the rest, going, walking past, going, "All right." So yeah, that guy's definitely a cop.
Oh man, I remember once I was at uni and we were like in line to get into the student union bar, and there was two guys. Like standing off to the side, and it was very clear that they were undercover people trying to score drugs.
Oh god.
So they could arrest people. And these looked like they were trying too hard to fit in.
Oh.
And it always reminds me of did you ever see Poker Face? The Columbo style murder show, which has what's her name from Russian Doll, and is Natasha created Young, by and created by Rian Johnson.
Yes, I saw the first, I want to say, 3 or 4 episodes, loved them, and then have not seen the rest.
Because in a later episode, there's a character who's played by John Hodgman, the PC guy in the Mac PC commercials, and he keeps trying. Everyone thinks he's a narc because he keeps going around going, "Hey, anyone have any drugs? Can I buy some drugs?" And they call him on. He's like, "No, I'm just really bad at trying to score drugs."
Oh god.
Like, he's the guy who literally would walk into a bar and go, "Hey, does anyone have cocaine they want to sell me?"
I mean, there are always those guys, you know. I remember my brother and I laughing at some people on a street corner that were basically that kind of in that sort of way. It's like, guys, this is amateur shit. Or on the level where it's like, "Do you want half a bike?" You know?
Wait, which half?
I mean, the half that wasn't chained down.
You know,
so, yeah.
if anyone from the town of Brighton ever hears our podcast, I'm going to be exiled for life and you're going to be tarred and feathered and run out of town. Because I swear...
telling the truths about it all.
How we sell our hometown in this show is basically, there's a whole bunch of ketamine addicts and there's more nightclubs that you can shake a stick at.
Oh, dear. It's there's also seagulls. A lot of very violent seagulls. It's great.
Do you know what we also have?
What?
A big list.
Yeah, our big list of best to worst Star Trek shows and films. Currently, it stands at 142 entries, all the way from the very top, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, up at number one. And then, let's see, we've got, skipping down a bit, in 50, we've got Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, from Discovery, with some time loop shenanigans, which I'm always a big fan of. 100, we have Kobayashi from Prodigy, where Dal annoys a lot of classic Star Trek characters in hologram form. And down the very bottom, we have Star Trek the Original Series' Plato's Stepchildren, where some Amdram theatre goes woefully out of hand. And we need to figure out where on our list Honor Among Thieves sits. So let's see. At the moment, I'm looking at the wounded possibly as a jumping off point, which is another O'Brien episode, but from TNG, where he's got his baggage with his old captain and the horrendous ties of duty between his past and present commands.
I think it just helps that Colm Meaney just has that one, just that perfectly put upon face. Like, no matter what happens to him, he always just looks like this is the worst thing that's ever happened to him. He just has that great, he has that perfect hangdog expression.
Yes. Yeah, there's I've seen him in a few things outside of this, and there is that, he just does that good kind of tired look.
I keep meaning to watch enough Always Sunny
to
get to the episode where we see Colm Meaney play, I think it's Charlie Day's dad.
Kind of. Yeah, it's, yeah. It's a fun show.
Like, I think the most fun I ever saw him in is he's in Con Air. He's in Con Air playing the FBI agent who's trying to catch the Con Air plane. And he just gets, like, he is a smarmy shit who gets what's coming to him. Like, it's a, you know, a good kind of character role. I don't know, like, the wounded, oof. Like, I enjoyed this episode. I had a lot of fun with this episode. I don't think it's a great episode.
It's... yeah, it's a good one. But yeah, I get that.
Like, the trouble is, it's a good one, but if you think about the essential mechanics of the plot for more than 5 seconds, you're like, this makes no sense. Why do they send an engineer on a space station, which is the front line of our intergalactic war? Why are we having him dick about with spy stuff?
And what they really should do, given as you've said, this is the front line of a big intergalactic war, and apparently he's the only engineer who knows how anything works, is get a fucking fleet of engineers there to learn from him.
Yeah,
because you can't have one point of failure. Not at that point.
No, not at like the not at the tactical strategic hub of the Alpha Quadrant.
So I see you on 92 with Balance of Terror.
See, I am actually looking at number 94, which is Prodigy First Contact, where we see Dal's Ferengi criminal mentor who immediately scans him. And yeah. I feel like in 20 minutes, you can't do a huge character deep dive. But I think that this episode is better than that because Bilby is a much more multifaceted character who never betrays O'Brien. Whereas with Dal's Ferengi mentor, betrays Dal like the second they meet again.
Yeah, it's a fun relationship, but yeah.
Whereas the moment, like the person who betrays Bilby is O'Brien. Whereas where Bilby's like, hey, you wanna stay on my sofa? You wanna feed my cat? I'll get you a new suit, I'll get you laid. That's how close we are, man.
God. Oh, I'm feeling bad for Bilby again now.
Yeah. Cause like in another episode, I feel in a much more conventional kind of crime spy show, the moment Bilby finds out, they would immediately have Bilby try and betray O'Brien to save his skin, whereas Hero's like, well, shit. I'm gonna do the right thing because there's honor amongst thieves.
Yeah, okay. So up from First Contact, in 93 we've got Yesteryear, where Spock accidentally gets removed from time, as you do. Which is, it's good fun for an animated series episode. You've got a nice bit of tragedy with some of it. You've got the oddness of Vulcan in general. Let's see. Oh, actually, thinking of criminals, we've got Menage a Troy at 91 which has a bunch of Ferengi kidnap Loxana.
Yep.
Right. And shenanigans ensue.
Is this the one which ends with Patrick Stewart going full Shakespeare?
Yeah.
To win back. Oh, goddamn, that part's so good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
I feel like in classic TNG, Picard never really gets, like, to do the, like, whenever the episode goes comedy, it feels like he has to be more serious and stayed than usual. So getting a chance to see Patrick Stewart kind of break out, to break out the Shakespeare for comedic effect.
Yeah, it's good fun. So what? Maybe just below Menage a Troy.
Yeah.
Cool. So that puts it in at number 92.
I just had a thought.
Oh.
We at some point we should do a micro list of just start ranking the O'Brien Must Suffer episodes.
Oh. Like the cat episodes.
Yes, and speaking of that, this episode had a kitty.
It did. It did. Chester, who will appear again.
Okay. So, at the moment... okay, I just open up the cat list again. We have all of... At number one, we have Cat's Paw with a giant cat. Number two, it is all of Lower Decks because of the cat crew member. And then last, we have the Changeling... Did we do that because Nomad acts like a cat at times?
I think it was more because it looked like something that would be used to scare off cats.
All right. So where do you think this goes on the big cat list?
I mean, Chester sadly does not have much of a core kind of part. So I think probably number three.
Number three. At least it's like, it's like, oh yeah, Bilby's not a bad guy because he clearly loves his cat.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And if Blake Snyder taught us anything aside from, hey, everyone's going to just use this same formula again and again until the end of time. It's, if they're good, then they save a cat.
All right. Not okay.
I've got issues with Blake Snyder's work.
No, we don't have issues with free act storytelling whatsoever.
Yeah. Speaking of which, it's time for Act Two. It's time for a present for me. Yeah.
All right, here you go.
Okay.
I wrapped it in castle wallpaper.
Ooh, I wonder why. Is this because of Minecraft, which I stopped playing a few years ago?
Oh, no, it's because, we British, we love our castles.
We do. Actually, I was at a craft fair yesterday and someone was selling stickers that say Time Team Nerd. And when I bought one, she was overjoyed for like one of those had sold, that there was another one of us out there.
Oh, Time Team, we miss you.
Yeah. So oh, okay. So it's something fairly new.
Yeah.
It's a Strange New Worlds. I can't remember if we've even done a Strange New Worlds this year. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, when did we do tomorrow?
That was episode 37, and we are currently on episode 59.
Oh, bloody hell. Okay.
Yeah.
No, maybe we haven't. Oh.
Yeah, but this one, it's Strange New Worlds, Season 2, Episode 4, titled Among the Lotus Eaters. It aired on the 6th of July, 2023, written by Kristen Beyer and Davy Perez, and directed by Eduardo Sanchez. The UK number one hit was Dave and Central C with Sprinter, and the US had Morgan Wallen with Last Night, which, it made Sprinter seem good.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, whenever it's that point of an evening, you're going, oh yeah, I ought to actually watch the videos for some of these. I've generally had them on with my partner and kind of chatted about which one is best or worst out of these. And there was just a lot of cursing at Morgan Wallen's, which was, yeah, not good. So yeah, but yeah, so this one, if you are watching along at home, then I will say there are some big tinnitus noises. I'm pretty sure there were some complaints of it, and as someone who, like William Shatner, suffers from tinnitus, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this episode. So yeah, I'll try not to edit in tinnitus noise. Instead, I'll probably just say tinnitus noise, and you're welcome.
Now, Charlie.
Yeah.
Before you forget, you have 5 minutes to recap this episode.
Who are you again?
I don't know. I think I am. I don't know. I think my name's Charlie.
Oh no.
And I have.
Does that mean I make for Blake 7 references?
Possibly. God no. I think your name is Sean, and I think you pay for Twitter.
Oh no, I'm the worst.
Okay. Since we've clearly forgotten what we're doing, pub.
Yeah, pub. Pub sounds good.
Pub sounds so good. Okay. All right, you have 5 minutes to go to the pub or recap an episode of Space 1999.
I mean, it's cold out, so I guess I could do the recap thing instead.
Right, fantastic. Okay. Right, and go.
Previously on Strange New Worlds, everyone's basically got a lot of drama going on. So now the Enterprise is currently assisting the USS Cayuga in charting a binary system. And that means date night for Captain Pike with Captain Battelle. She's got a cool new necklace for him, but the pair keep getting in calls interrupting their date. Pike suggests maybe have a break in their relationship. Una calls Pike about Rigel 7. They were there 5 years ago. It's a Bronze Age planet and they couldn't scan things, so they went in unprepared. They lost 3 people and something weird's going on. Long-range photos show a Starfleet Delta. That's weird. Have they made a cargo cult? They need to find out. So, this opens up from our credits with Ortegas's log. She flies the ship, and now she gets to LARP as a Rigelian and pilot a shuttle down. She's stoked. She's even got a hat. And too late, she's benched. The Enterprise needs complicated maneuvering to keep around an asteroid belt and keep it safe. So it'll just be Pike, Mbenga, and La'an. They're not even taking any Starfleet technology because they want to be as inconspicuous as possible. And then there's a horrid tinnitus noise and La'an's outside. They all are. She's a bit disorientated and they camp and have a bit of a scout of the perimeter. The guards have guns, which last time I checked isn't very Bronze Age. And then, oh god, they've got company. Soldiers with guns who say, hey, we know you're from Starfleet, come with us. And there's a tinnitus noise. Now they're in the castle, and Zach Nguyen's there. He was one of the people that was apparently killed in action. And now he's in charge of everyone and inside a giant space castle. Pike, of course, still hopes for the best, asks if the Delta was maybe some kind of distress call, given how they can't normally scan her. And nope, Zach's just made himself king, he's not going back. And it's fine, though, tomorrow, none of those guys are going to remember a thing. And sure enough, there's a tinnitus noise, and they're in a cage. La'an is doing really badly, she doesn't recognise Pike or Mbenga, and Mbenga doesn't remember who they were speaking to. None of them remember why they were here. Up on the Enterprise, things aren't looking good either. Uhura's getting some of that horrible tinnitus now. She's also missing time. Ortegas offers to escort her to sickbay, and Nurse Chapel can't tell what's wrong with her. says, hopefully it's not infectious, just in time for Spock to call in and say another 6 people are similarly affected. Down on the planet, the away team wakes up and are told they're in a cage to stop them from wandering off, because people go through the forgetting pretty regularly here. They've got a new friend, an old man, who tells them to be in the moment, not in a hippie way, in a necessity way. He helps them over to a labour camp. Apparently they had a hard forgetting. The Kalar in the palace have memories, and the Kalar outside have markings who say who they are, basically so that they always live in the present instead of dwelling on things. Pike notices his soft hands and reckons, hang on, I'm not a labourer. Look at these lovely digits. Oh, also I've got this necklace and it's evoking something. Pike fights a guard who's being a dick, knocks him out. Lan joins in and gets knifed in the stomach. M'Benga tries to heal her and the old man offers to help, but it's not right.
Mm? You know, Charlie, if that is your name, I used to be a Rigelian guard until I took a hammer to the head.
Oh, dear. I think that's a recruiting exercise for them as well. Anyway, Chapel's now seeing neural degradation across the crew. The implicit memory is there, but any experience is going. Una forgets partway through the explanation of this, but a third of the crew are affected, and they're guessing it's weird radiation from the planet. The bridge is now mostly empty, and Spock hands Ortegas a pad with her CV on it. She flies the ship. As long as she remembers that, she's good. Back on the planet, the old man takes the away team to his tent, and it's huge. It's a nice big tent. He encourages M'Benga and Pike to just let their memories go and let Lan die, because they'll forget her soon enough. M'Benga's not having any of it, and the old man's like, no, mate, it's a blessing. There's a weird totem in the middle of the tent explaining how society works, these two castes, with the nobility remembering.
Oh. What are we doing again?
I think I've got to start recapping an episode.
Okay, all right. So I've got a timer here for 5 minutes.
Okay.
I think you've got 5 minutes to recap this episode, or it's the cage.
Oh, no. I don't want to go into the cage.
Look, my friend, you clearly had a hard forgetting. Here, try and recap some Star Trek and see how that does you.
Right. So, yes, where was I? There's a big totem in the tent explaining about the nobility keeping their memories and the field folk being free. And there's a casket that apparently helps the nobles keep their memories. The old man's doubtful about Pike and M'Benga's plan, but he likes their energy, so he's going to help them anyway. They head off, dragging Lan as well. And Pike promises to get even the old man's memories back. But it's like, no, I'm fine without them. I even inked over some tattoos so that I don't remember whatever was on there. Ortegas gets a big tinnitus wave. Here's some beeping. She and Spock have no memory and they can't even read the pads to say who they are. She flees into a turbo lift and people are wandering the halls like zombies. She needs a computer to help navigate to her room. Pike and M'Benga storm the castle, but after doing most of the work, M'Benga's injured and Pike goes in alone. Ortegas yells at the computer, wanting asteroids to stop hitting the ship, but is told, well, she's the one that has to work it out, as she flies the ship. And yeah, that feels right. She keeps repeating her name, and that she flies the ship again and again, like a mantra as she goes back to the bridge. In the palace, Pike finds Zack and the pair have a shootout. Pike wins and flings Zack to the floor, asking for his memories back. Zack's just laughing at all this and gets a good kicking for his efforts. Ortegas, though, she flies that damn ship. She even shoots away for an asteroid rather than steering past it. Zack, on the planet, shows the casket. It's a crate full of Starfleet tech. It can't bring back memories, obviously. That's just local superstitions. The palace is made from an ore that protects the people inside from memory loss, as do their funny hats. Pike almost shoots Zack, and there we go, his memories are back again. he puts the gun down and says, no, no, came to save people. And this planet, it's kind of revealed people's true selves. Pike still wanted to rescue people, even with no memory. He mourned Zach, but apparently Zach was just a dick. And he's going to space jail. Mbenga's memory's back and he heals Lan with the Starfleet tech. The old man's in the palace and actually pleased to get memories of his son back. Ortegas now has her memories returned and Spock's enhanced the shields to help block the amnesia radiation. The Enterprise tows the amnesia asteroid off the planet. It's possibly a bit of a Prime Directive issue, but we'll let it fly. Pike and Batel meet up again and he says, yeah, this whole going on a break thing, like this necklace, our relationship saved him. It reminded him who he was and he can't just walk away from something like that. So they're going to still try and keep the relationship going. And that's that.
Okay. You managed to recap all of that in 1 minute with 1 minute, 43 seconds left to go on the timer.
That doesn't sound right.
I'm sure we'll work it out later.
Okay. Yes. So, amnesia. It's something we often see in a TV show.
Yeah. I always remember that one, the side plot in the first season of 24, when Jack Bauer's wife, Terry, gets amnesia for like the second half of the show because they had no idea what to do with her.
Oh God, I forgot about that. It was terrible. Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes there are good uses for amnesia.
Yeah.
And then there's that. It's a tricky tool to use and sometimes used better than others. Like just remembering that as a bad thing. Did you ever watch Chuck?
I watched the first few seasons.
So, like, the finale felt like it was a bit rushed to, and Sarah gets her memory wiped and is kind of being used by the enemy, and while they kind of get together by the end of it, she still has no memory and is kind of needs Chuck to teach her who she is and who he is and all of that, and it felt a bit weird as a place to end it on. She's still gone, that version of her. Weird.
There's a running joke amongst Doctor Who fans. For a good chunk of the Paul McGann TV movie, the Doctor has amnesia, and there's a recurring element in Eighth Doctor stories, partially because, you know, just because like the Eighth Doctor didn't have like a set personality, that the Eighth Doctor seems to keep getting amnesia over all the novels, comics, and Big Finish audios that he has been in, either due to, you know, plot laziness or plot reasons. So it is a joke in Doctor Who fandom that the Eighth Doctor is the one who just gets amnesia at the drop of a hat.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Maybe it's just attention span issues.
Maybe
something, you know? I liked this episode this time seeing it. I can't remember why I wasn't as keen when I first saw it, when it originally aired. Some of it might have been a tinnitus noise where it's like,
Oh no, I dug this episode.
Yeah.
It had a nice, good, strong concept. Admittedly, calling everything The Forgetting just feels like a very classic 60s Trek thing to do.
Definitely.
So, yep. If Kirk and Spock were on this planet and they found out there was like a power imbalance where you have a caste system, you know that Kirk and Spock are like, right,
car system.
Let's topple an empire. And while it didn't have that kind of energy, man, it's sometimes great to see our heroes topple a corrupt regime.
Definitely, definitely. And
especially one led by a guy called Zach.
Yes. Yeah, Zach was a real jerk. And it is that thing as well of going, oh yeah, this is a Starfleet person with all this knowledge who left, like, might have had his memory come and go throughout it all, but ultimately figuring he's been abandoned and going like, yep, I guess I run this place now because I've got technology. If they're never coming back, who's going to know?
Yeah.
And yeah, creating a belief system, which especially with the forgetting is would be incredibly easy to do.
Okay, so you got the thing that he made, that he kind of created the whole kind of cast of. I just kind of got the feeling that he just kind of saw a vacuum and then took control.
Or maybe there was some fundamental kind of Bronze Age equivalent of him, of this structure being made. But, you know, like a big fancy palace was made, like a proper castle.
Yeah.
You know, this was, you know, it wasn't as hokey as the Catspaw Castle.
Or as hokey as the Space Castle from the Cage.
Of course.
This is the planet Rigel 7 where Pike had a bad experience before the events of the Cage.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would imagine that he brought a level of advancement to both whatever existing caste system there was and things like the palace, you know, the fact that they had a nice big Starfleet Delta there as his kind of his logo. That's a worrying sign for anyone in Starfleet, but also, yeah, how many people are there that are going to go onto a planet, get left behind and go full Kurtz?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it was it's fun seeing, I like the utopian angle of Starfleet and of Star Trek and all of the hope in that. I'd rather not be, you know, ooh, I'm an edgy boy with it all. But sometimes going, oh yeah, sometimes you will just get a real bad egg.
Well, this is still kind of classic era where it didn't feel, I don't think it's as defined as it becomes in TNG to the point of kind of ludicrousness. I mean, I remember, like, with City on the Edge of Forever, Harl Nelson wrote a character who was a member of the crew who was a drug dealer.
Yeah.
And Gene Roddenberry kind of went, no, I don't want a drug dealer on my ship. I just want McCoy to just go crazy through drugs that he injected into himself because he's an idiot.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, normal stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I really dug this. I really dug this episode. I liked a lot of the memory stuff. I liked the fact that we had the guy who's on the planet who's okay being a Lotus Eater.
Yeah, or at least, you know, he'd had enough of it go on that he had figured out his coping mechanisms, but also that he wasn't, once his memories returned, he's like, no, actually, that was bad, not having the memories, not remembering who I've lost or anything like that, because, yeah, it's a rough thing, and, you know, kind of trying to avoid that grief and that kind of state, it's not healthy, ultimately.
No.
So, yeah, yeah, it's another one of those episodes of Strange New Worlds, which kind of works fine as its own thing and helps kind of differentiate itself from where Discovery tends to be episodes that are a bit too connected. This is one that stands perfectly by itself.
Yeah.
Even with the relationship things and all that. So, yeah, it was a good time. So, with that in mind, where are we putting it on our list? Now, the pilot of Strange New Worlds is still in our number 4 spot here, as it's just a very good unit of Trek and a very good introduction to Star Trek as a concept. It's not going to be beating that.
No.
We've got the musical at 23. We've got Spockamock at 39. We may not have covered much Strange New Worlds, but it has done well.
At the same time, you know, we cannot forget Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach, which was, for the longest time, our bottom-ranking episode of Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, it did not go well.
No. But I feel that one is just like, it's... There are so many reasons about why that episode is terrible, which we have screamed and sworn about at length.
Yeah, it's nice having a new bottom shooter to replace it occasionally.
And like, it was nice to have a strong Ortegas focused episode, because I think after Hema, rest in peace Hema, Ortegas is my favorite of the new characters brought into the show.
Yeah, now I think this is one of a few times that Ortegas gets much to do in season two, but the actress was like, had a lot of stuff going on that meant being kind of pulling back a little bit involvement wise, which is understandable. But this very much coins Ortegas, she flies for ship. Like, as an almost mimetic thing. If anyone thinks Ortegas, it's for, yep, ship.
And I wish she'd kept the hat. I wish that she'd been wearing the hat, just sulkily wearing it while at the bridge.
I kind of hope we just even see it in the background in our quarters. Yeah. One day she'll get to go onto a world.
I did like her little interplay with Spock.
Hmm.
Where he's just trying to be apologetic, and she's like, no, just leave it, mate.
Yeah, they're not a pairing you'd see much of.
No.
Okay. Let's see. I mean, what? In 50, we've got Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, which is time loop kind of stuff. And while this was memory loss more than time loop, there's that kind of thing. There's, let's see, I think Cage is... Is Cage higher up?
Okay, I think Cage is in our...
Cage is lower. Cage, which again, you...
The 31.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like both this and Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad is where New Trek... I think this is where New Trek is at its best, because it remembers that this has... That we. It just has to be fun television.
Yes.
It can be part of an ongoing arc, but I feel this is sometimes these are the kind of things that we lose in doing our very heavily serialized HBO 13 episode shows, where it's just like, just have an episode where everyone kind of gets to wander around and go a little bit mad.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, a few spots up in 45, we have Strange New Worlds is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which I think's probably a bit better, but it's pretty much just a two-hander with La'an and an alternate Kirk. And the kind of love and tragedy of that.
I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is this better than The Infinite Vulcan, where we get a giant Spock?
Oh, God.
Because that is the episode above Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad.
What a list. I think even though Giant Spock is very good fun, this is better than Giant Spock.
Okay, fine. All right, fine. Then. Fine. And then number... Okay, then at number 46, right underneath Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, we have Meld, where Tuvok gets to go a bit Hannibal Lecter. And we've got Brad Dourif. No one... Zach is a very damp looking God King. Zach is a very damp looking individual. He has very greasy hair.
He does. He's nowhere near as interesting as an individual as Brad Dourif. But at the same time, I feel the scenario is more fun than, hey, here's a serial killer that's not really.
Great. Yeah, like we have killing. Brad Dourif like being like going all out to kind of be a creepy serial killer. And then we have David Hyun as Zach, who is basically like a greasy middle management, a greasy temp who declares himself God King.
I mean, I know I've met those.
I mean, Zach definitely has Starbucks supervisor who had the power go to his head straight away.
Yeah.
Vibes immediately.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Okay. So, well, yeah, should we say between tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and Meld?
Oh, I would say between Meld and The Assignment, which is number 47.
Oh, yeah.
Which was another O'Brien Must Suffer episode.
Yes.
But also it has Rom trying to make friends.
Oh, yeah, the true horror of that episode. Okay, yeah, I'm good with that. That puts this at 47. So, yeah, I feel we've not got anything in the number ones, like, in the highest spot, but also we've not got anything in the lowest for this episode. So, you know, no lumps of coal, no future tense, which was on the bottom of the list for a little while before The Justice Where Suffering Cannot Reach. Yeah, although I'm sure one Christmas there will be revenge. But in the meantime, that's going to be it for us in 2024 with Casual Trek. We've got a little treat for you as a mini episode between now and when we're back properly reviewing episodes of Star Trek. And until then, where can people find us, Miles?
Well, they can find us on our Blue Sky account at casualtrek.bsky.social. You can find me on my Blue Sky account at milesreedlabato, all one word, .bsky.social. And you can find me on my blog at mareedlabato.wordpress.com. And by the time this episode has dropped, there actually might be a new blog post where I talk about our town's local science fiction and fantasy nerd-related pub quiz, the Geekest Link, and how for a while I was essentially the villain of your average sports movie.
Oh no, Miles. How could you? You weren't sponsored by someone who was going to knock down the building.
No, I wasn't.
Into a car park or a mall.
No, no. And I think what's funny, I think one of your flatmates may have hated me, even though I had never met them.
Oh, wow.
I think I remember you telling me about him.
Probably.
And Charlie, where can they find you?
Yeah, so not being the villain in a 1980s sports movie, luckily. Yeah, so you can find me also on Blue Sky with all the cool kids now at skyshark.bsky.social. I've got some RPG reviews. Hopefully I'll finally finish a write-up of the Dragon Meat convention on Who Dares Rolls. And I'm playing through an advent calendar solo RPG called Advent of Abomination on fakedtales.com. Every 3 days or so I'm putting up a blog post covering a character's experience in a cabin in the woods where, as of recording, it's just about to get weird, and where you're listening, it's probably getting pretty grim for the character. So have fun reading those. So yeah, and yeah, go do a Starfleet, even for Christmas.
Happy holidays. And have a jelly baby.
Yes.
Or a nice mince pie.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and High podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Labato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.